Okay, this is talking with Sebastian von Herner in his office at Green Bank, West Virginia, on 23rd February 1977. Well, could you please tell me a little bit about your educational background and when you first became involved in radio astronomy and heard about radio astronomy?
What I originally studied was relativity physics.
Where was it?
This was in Göttingen after the war. And then I got interested in hydrodynamics and finally made my thesis with von Weizsäcker, and we applied hydrodynamical concepts like turbulence and later on shockwaves to astrophysical problems, and this is the way I came to astrophysics.
I see. Which kind of problems do you use?
Well, in general, the behavior of gas in the Milky Way, let's say, or in some of stars, clouds, and what kind of turbulent motion you have, and could we apply our laws of turbulence, like the Kolmogorov spectrum, mm-hmm. to the motions we see. And in addition, what do we do if it gets compressible? Because all our laws of turbulence are confined to the incompressible case.
Did you go to any of these conferences, like there was one in Cambridge?
Not recently. Yes, in Cambridge I was.
Yeah. 53 was it?
Yes. And that was my first conference.
There were some radio astronomers out there. Do you remember that at all? Did it strike you in any sense about what was happening?
Somehow at this time, radio astronomy hadn't appeared in my horizon.
Yeah. So when did you finally obtain your PhD?
Oh, 51 or 52.
And you stayed on in Göttingen?
Yes, and I stayed with von Weizsäcker, and we worked on astrophysical problems, and mostly in connection with hydrodynamics. And later on I got very interested in other things like dynamics of groups of stars, star clusters.
Mm-hmm.
So I was busy on the n-body problem, and actually I was the first who just integrated the n-body problem on a computer,
mm-hmm.
starting with a random configuration.
Which computer was it?
This was a very slow computer, and in order to make it work, I could only use weekends where nobody else wanted it, and I had to make my whole program completely automatic so that when the next user come on Monday morning, he just pushed a certain button and all the present state was punched on tape, and so I could enter that and continue next weekend. And so that took many weekends.
Right, but when was this about?
This was around 60.
And which computer, what kind of computer?
Well, this was finally in Heidelberg. This was after I had moved from Göttingen to Heidelberg. I was sent in the Astronomische Zeichen-Institut in Heidelberg. And we had a Siemens, I forgot the number, and you would now consider it possibly slow.
But that's not really relevant. Was it one of the best at that time available in Germany?
Yes. And actually, I've been in the computer business from the very start on, in our Max Planck Institute in Göttingen, where I grew up, so to say. We developed and built the first electronic computer on the continent. I mean, at this time, America had some, and England had one,
mm-hmm.
but on the continent, we developed the first.
Mm. And what was the name of that computer?
Oh, G1, Göttingen 1. And it was not built for computing with it, it was built for learning how to build computers.
I see.
And when it was finished, we found out, gee, we can use it.
Mm.
It made 5 operations per second,
mm-hmm.
and it had a memory of 26 words.
It's 5 times faster than a human.
And finally we found all kinds of tricks and we solved even partial differential equations with it. But after that, I mean, this drove you crazy.
What is the...
It was very exciting.
What is the title of the Max Planck Institute in Göttingen?
This was the overall institute was for physics, theoretical physics.
Mm-hmm.
And Heisenberg was the director.
Right.
And it had a department for astrophysics, and there was Biermann and von Weizsäcker. And I was in Weizsäcker's group. And he's a very fascinating man. And actually, he is the reason that I came to astrophysics. I wanted to be his student, no matter which field.
I see. What was it about the man that fascinated you?
Tremendous broad background. For example, he had studied physics, but he got offered a chair for philosophy, which in Germany is next to impossible, you know, that you get a chair offered for something you haven't studied.
Right.
And also a very remarkable person on the personal side. So I was very glad I was his first student and we all came on.
So when was it that you first began to be cognizant of radio astronomy? When did you
Well, this came much later then. I was in Heidelberg, and I think it was end of 59 or beginning of 60 that I got a letter from Otto Struve, who then was director here at Green Bank, and he invited me to come for 1 year as visitor. And I thought, geez, must be a mistake. So right. I wrote a letter back to him that I feel very honored and pleased by this offer. But I should honestly tell him that I never had the slightest touch with radio astronomy. I just barely know the field exists. And he wrote back, he's well aware of this, and he still invites me, and I could do whatever I like. And then my second letter was, well, sir, I have warned you, but now I accept. And so I came as a visitor, and I really got fascinated by the field of radio astronomy and by the people I met here and by the whole spirit of the place.
What do you think was Struve's motivation to have a theorist on staff?
Yes, and just to get more people with broad backgrounds, I think.
Rather than electronic engineers or people that knew radio receivers.
Yes, yes. You just wanted to have a broad variety of people.
And so you came here in 1960?
In 1960, and just with my wife. Mm-hmm. And we left the children in various places in Germany. And stayed here for a year, and I got completely fascinated by all I learned.
Tell me about who was here and the people who were fascinating.
Well, I liked school very much. And I got very fascinated and also good friends with Frank Blake. And this was just the time of Project Osma, and now that was a really great thing. And actually, I had thought about life in space long before that, but wasn't aware of that this is something to take serious scientifically. Yeah.
That it was feasible to actually...
Yes, that you really could do something. Mm-hmm. So that was a great time.
Did you participate in Project Osma at all?
No, it was just over coffee breaks.
Right.
But lots of stuff. Yeah. Actually, coffee breaks are very important thing here in Green Bank. And from the beginning on, they played a big role.
Yeah.
We have lots of discussions. Sometimes we claim all the important things are discussed over coffee break, and the rest of the time we work out the details.
Well, I've always been impressed by the cafeteria, which has paper and pencil.
Yes,
on every table, just ready to go.
Well, the first years we used the placemats and napkins. And
do you know who came up with that idea?
No.
It's
here, long ago.
Now, Struve was only here for a year or 2 years after you...
Yes, it might be 2 years. And he was a marvelous man and a very good scientist. But the trouble was he was just too old to build up something completely new and out of his field.
Mm-hmm.
If it had been an optical observatory, would have been okay. Or if the place had been built up already and he could take over, that would have been okay. But it was just too much, and so he also felt frustrated and didn't feel to have enough strength and insight to really do the job as good as he wanted. So he felt frustrated, and also his health was very bad. But I think this goes to that.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Why was it, at least to your knowledge, that the directors picked a prominent optical astronomer? The AUI picked an optical astronomer?
Yeah, this I cannot tell. I can only guess, and I would think the idea was it should be someone with a lot of experience, which means older. This time there was no old radio astronomer around. Struve just was well known and had a very broad background and was very open-minded.
Well, particularly, I mean, Osma apparently.
Yes.
All.
Yeah. And he was good, boss, no question. Only the problem with 140-foot was overwhelming.
Yeah.
Other things.
What other people were fascinated you with, and what other conditions here fascinated you at that time?
Well, there was Heeshan and Roger Linz, and I don't know, I think Coach Romanov was also here, but I had a very bad memory.
Yeah, he came in.
But what fascinated me was sort of the total of it, not so much the details, but the spirit of the place.
Right.
It was something at this time coming from Germany, which was just tremendously different.
Can you describe the power?
Oh, things in Germany were much more formal and stiff at the time, and old-fashioned and traditional. Here, all of a sudden, everything was possible. And the contact between people was much closer.
On the staff, you mean?
Yes, on the staff and also to the director and to the students on the other side. It was much more personal and free and frank.
Mm-hmm.
And lots of cooperation and not so much competition. Or nobody gave a damn for his career. They all were just interested in what they were doing.
Mm-hmm. Now, you say that all things were possible, but still, there was only a single 85-foot dish here.
Yes, but there were, I mean, if someone came up with the idea for a new telescope, it was considered possible. Right?
Yeah.
Why not? It's mm-hmm. only a few million dollars, but not sure.
Okay. And so I guess that's the way the 300-foot got built, you
yes.
think? Were you involved at all in thinking of the 300, about the design of the 300-foot?
No, not at this time. I had started to think about telescope designs very early, even in this first year as a visitor. The way it went was that I got very interested in cosmology, and by studying it for a while, I had the feeling we don't need any more new theories. We have already much too many, and we cannot make a decision between any two of them. So what we need is more observation, and when I looked into that, I found out we need more telescopes. And at this time, I tried to design a telescope, a one-purpose telescope, for cosmological purposes.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, later on, this was given up. It turned out it was too expensive for a single-purpose telescope.
What was this telescope going to do?
Oh, it was a reflecting cross. It's like a cross antenna, but reflecting from both arms into over mirrors into one focus.
I see.
So it would be a pencil beam instrument with a very high resolution. But with a limited steerability.
And this was, what data were you interested in?
Well, this was, yes, log S and more resolution.
So it appears then that you had hope that log N, log S would
yes, at this time we had a lot more hope than we have now at our side.
Well, you'd be a good person to ask since you came
about
in.
About high resolution, for example, this was also badly needed, and this would have been one way of getting it.
What sort of frequency were you thinking of?
I don't know.
Well, but lower, what would high end, roughly?
Well, let's say 20 centimeters.
Yeah. Okay, so you held a diffusion problem.
Down to 10 or 5 centimeters, I think, was that? Yeah, down to 5 centimeters.
So you greatly helped the confusion problem, which hurts the low frequency.
Yes,
service.
Yes.
But you'd be a good person to ask, being somewhat unbiased at that stage, if you can remember how you were thinking. Here you had the 2C and then 3C surveys, and you had Mills' survey, and of course the battle's going on.
Yes, and
how did you view this?
At this time they didn't agree at all, and I studied this for a while, and I actually came up with a solution that they both had underestimated the confusion limit,
mm-hmm.
and had badly underestimated it, so they were both confused, and because of that, didn't agree and had lots of wrong sources.
Yeah, and that was basically right.
Yeah.
Mills, perhaps not quite as much as the in Cambridge. Now, did you ever publish?
Yes, I published a paper about the confusion limit, and this has been used later on widely.
Where was that? I'm sure you remember that.
I would have figured it out.
Okay. And so, You still had, you didn't lose faith in radio astronomy because of this discrepancy.
No, contrary. Lots of things to be done.
Right, but I think some theorists perhaps did, or at least optical astronomers, they looked at it and said, good Lord, get your house in order and then we'll listen to you or something.
Well, yes, and that's a good statement, and we tried to get our house in order.
Do you remember this attitude at all in talking with other cosmologists?
Oh, yes, sure.
Can you name any names? Okay, so how did you get into antenna design? I guess it was,
well, this
that's
was
right, through trying to solve the cosmological...
Yes, first I was here only this one here, and then we went back to Heidelberg, and because of our children, we had the feeling... I mean, I was offered to stay here, but we had the feeling we can't do it, and we have to go back. And then later on came the big meeting in Berkeley, and I saw all these colleagues again. And
that's the 61 IAU.
Yes, yeah. And when all my love for Green Bank came back, and it didn't need much talking to talk me into coming back.
Mm-hmm.
And we found that we just couldn't make it, that my wife stayed with one, with two children a little longer, for the oldest to finish high school, and I came here with the second boy. And a year later, my wife came with the rest of the family.
Okay.
And so we somehow managed. It was difficult with schools, but we somehow managed, and mm-hmm. the children haven't been hurt by it, not at all.
And you've been here ever since.
Yeah.
So, but why was it that you got more and more into antenna design, even though it wasn't really cosmology?
Yes.
Your training had not been in structural engineering and so forth.
But I have changed my field of activities several times in my life, many times.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just one of these things where all of a sudden a new field, which I hadn't thought of before, I had never touched, got so fascinating that I forgot about everything else. And so the last 10 years, I have devoted most of my time to engineering problems.
What was it that fascinated you about this?
Well, I think I got this idea fairly early that there are natural limits in telescope design. Well, let's say I discussed it with engineers. What defines the accuracy of a telescope, which means the shortest wavelength, and what defines the cost, the price of a telescope. And I was completely dissatisfied with the answers. And I had the feeling nobody had studied these things from scratch, from basic physical things on. And so very early I developed what I called natural limits of telescopes regarding the accuracy, which means that for a given size, you cannot make it more accurate than a certain accuracy given by that size, and no matter what you spend. But within or up to that limit, the accuracy shouldn't depend much on, or the cost shouldn't depend much on the accuracy.
Mm-hmm.
So building a sloppy telescope is not much cheaper than building the best for that size.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the first. And when I developed these natural limits, the most important one was what I called the gravitational limit. That gravitational deformations really define the precision of a telescope. So the next question was, what can you do about it? And then I found that it is not the deformations, but the deviations from a parabola, which only matters.
Mm-hmm.
And that the receiver automatically makes, so to say, a best fit, or finds the best fitting parabola